And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. I'm Kristen, and on season two, I'm joined by legendary rock star Patty Quatro, where we take a deep dive into her Detroit roots, the indelible impact of her iconic musical family, her two pioneering all-female bands, The Pleasure Seekers and Cradle, hanging with her homeboys in Detroit Rock City, and so much more. So let's get started. Patty, we have spoken so much about your brother, Michael Quatro, in his youth, in the younger years. And in season three, we are going to be discussing him so much more because he really was so influential in Detroit Rock City and what was happening there. But I want you to just tease the audience a little bit about his incredible musical gifts. And we talked a little bit about this on season one, but you told me the story about how Aerosmith, I believe, refused to go on after a performance of your brother's in Detroit. Were there other instances of bands not wanting to go on after seeing him? Or tell us a little bit more.
Well, they didn't actually refuse to go on, but they did not want to go on. They put it in their book that there was this guy that came out, played like, I don't know, 12 pianos or something. He was playing them backwards and everything. And he had this huge thing with effects and lights and going on. And the audience was going bananas. I mean, he did his Court of the Crimson King and people with the flames up and everything, because he did a version of that that was known all over the U.S. because it elevated the song. I hate to say, you know, be irreverent to the original, but his was better, and it had Ted Nugent on it too. But anyway, he did all this and all his classical rock, and he was pretty much like a forerunner before Rick Wakeman, before ELP. I mean, he was, geez, you know, the talent he had. But they did not feel comfortable going on and trying to go after him. And they had the same managers, Lieber and Krebs, and they were famous managers out of New York City, and they did Aerosmith too. And they just wanted Mickey, you know, bless his heart, they wanted to put him in whitetails up on stage and just play and tape his mouth. Like I always say, tape his mouth, don't let him talk, let his music speak for him. So that was the deal. You know, it was always like that with him.
Well, we are going to be discussing your brother again and all of his talents, musical talents, his business talents, his visions, everything in season three. And we will be playing a lot of his music, including the song that you just mentioned. Say the name again, Court of the Crimson, I believe.
Court of the Crimson King.
Yes, exactly. But I want to know, since we've set the stage with your brother, having gone to Lawrence Welk at the age from 15 to 17 years old, he is this prodigy, if you will, and he comes home and now he's almost a business prodigy, setting the stage with this new Detroit Rock City energy that's coming up. So I think it's important now that we rewind the story a bit and place you and your band, the Pleasure Seekers, back into the story of this new Detroit Rock City, or as I'm calling it, Detroit Quattro Rock City. But by the time Mickey is beginning to launch his biz, if you will, as a promoter, as a booking agent, you're finding yourself a budding and talented musician. You haven't quite formed the Pleasure Seekers yet, but you are totally into music. And I believe that you, Patty, mentioned you were really into folk at the time. And as a reminder to those who were not there or may not know this, the thing that was so exciting about Detroit in this moment in time is there was such a diversity of musical genres, including the openness of what you could play. So Patty, talk about folk, what you were into, and how did you make the transition to wanting to do, as you call it, the rock?
Okay, well, within the family, it's interesting, I'll widen it just a little bit, because Arlene, you know, she was married with kids and everything. She was in the doo-wop era. You went from dad's da-di-da stuff, you know, the classics and all that, into the doo-wop era, her with her DA, which they called a ducktail, you know, this hairdo, Bobby Socks, and listening to Neil Sedaka, and, you know, those kinds of bands, Loafers, you know, just doo-wop. And that was going out, And the rock stuff was starting to filter in. You still had the folk music going on. So I was sort of caught in between those genre. That's what happened. You know, Elvis, Bobby Darin, all those kind of people. And I was listening to Peter, Paul, and Mary, and they were big. And there were the coffee houses all through Detroit, you know, where you could do it. And I think I did see Peter, Paul, and Mary live. I'm not quite remembering if I did, but I was into them. But then we were hanging out with the teens, and they were starting bands. You know, they were getting interested in this music. You were hearing this stuff about the Beatle invasion, you know, just the British invasion, basically. And it was like Detroit Rock City was slowly becoming a melting pot for everything. We had the best of the East Coast, the best of the West Coast, the Southern, and the folk music was in there. Everything was sort of bubbling up, you know, and it cooking. So,
well, and also, sorry to interrupt, but also let's not forget the influence of Motown.
I was just getting to that. Motown was always, you know, that's in the DNA of Detroit. It's Motown and Cars. That was never forgotten. It's always there. But so we were jamming, Nan and Diane and I, we were starting to fiddle with our instruments and jamming and all that. And we also became real close at that time after we started in hanging with the Blues Magoos at the Chessmate Coffee House in Detroit. And they were psychedelic. You know, they were, oh my God. We hung with them. We would sneak out at night with the car, Dad's Cadillac, and we would go downtown where we weren't supposed to ever go and get in there with our fake ID. And we hung with them, became very close with them, and they come into other stories in the future. But, you know, Nan was dating the drummer, and Susie was dating the bass player, and we were all into music, and we would stay all night at the hotel and jam and talk. They did a version of Tobacco Road that was amazing. It was amazing, something that excited us that we'd never heard before. So this also was bubbling up along with the boys that we were playing with, you know, the hometown boys making their bands. Every one of them from a different neighborhood. You went to concerts, you would hear, I don't know, Elton John in one place, somebody else in another, and every one of them would have a crowd to capacity. That's how diverse Detroit was. Every neighborhood had their calling card of what kind of music they were creating and bubbling up. So you got to realize all this jamming and coming together honed our craft. I'm so blessed to have been grown up in that. Oh my God, you had the Amboy Duke starting with Mad Men guitar maestro Ted Nugent with his leaping giant, you know, his gymnastics wearing this loincloth. You had Iggy Stooge, who was like the original mosh pit guy. I mean, you know, very raw, primitive. That was Iggy. Bobby Seger, who was 2 years older than us, most of us. He was the storyteller, and he was bubbling up, starting teaching Glenn Frey how to write lyrics. I mean, it was the scene was amazing. You had Question Mark and the Mysterians. You had Grand Funk, who was another big band, and their flamboyant frontman, Mark Farner, you know, hippie people's raucous band type guy. Then you had Mitch Ryder, rock and roll, blue-eyed soul. He was so good. He had a great little voice, and his music was just like a freight train, just very soulful.
And the rap, I like to call Mitch Ryder your former boyfriend as well.
Well, we dated a little bit. You know, it didn't last very long. I went on the road again. You know? I mean, we were the earliest ones out of Detroit. We were traveling all the time.
And I need to interrupt a little bit. I'm so sorry, because you have said so many important things that I don't want to let go. But I think it bears repeating in terms of Detroit and geography, and why, as I like to say as a historian, that geography matters as much as anything else. And I was thinking about this when I was watching your brother, Mickey, on Lawrence Welk. And Lawrence was asking him where he resided. And he said, I'm from a suburb outside of Detroit. And Lawrence asked him where, and he said Grosse Pointe. And I think Lawrence said, how far is that? And he said, it's like 3 miles. And the audience laughed as if, like, that's not a suburb. It's only 3 miles. I think they were, but I thought, well, actually, he's so right, because Grosse Pointe could not be any different, literally and figuratively, those 3 miles from Detroit downtown to Grosse Pointe. And so completely. The actions that you're talking about, when you say they come from these different areas, you know, it wasn't necessarily in downtown Detroit, even though it's called Detroit Rock City. Motown, though, was, but that's not the point.
MC5 were, I think, pretty much downtown, you know, with their political. You had Plum Street going on and Cream Magazine starting, which was competing with Circus and Rolling Stone. You had a whole environment bubbling up at this time in Detroit. So Detroit was like the center, but all these little neighborhoods, I mean, Grosse Pointe was real frat, you know, real mod, you know, and the other ones, there was a greaser area. I mean, all the different, you know, you want to put labels on it, and they all had their kind of music that they were digging.
But didn't you say that Wayne Kramer was from Ann Arbor, that they were originated from that area before they went to Detroit?
I think, you know what? God, my memory. I think they were very involved in downtown Detroit and Plum Street. There was places they hung at and stuff. I don't know if they actually lived in Ann Arbor. I know Iggy did. He was the frat boy.
Maybe
in
that's
Ann Arbor,
what I was thinking.
Dating our drummer. You know, he wasn't even in the band yet. And, you know, all these different places. Alice was in the mix. He had his farmhouse.
Patty, you are so funny, because you're just throwing out these stories like, oh, this is just so normal as I'm talking about my youth. Please go back to Iggy Pop dating your drummer.
Oh, my God. He was in, I think the name of the band was the Iguanas, the earliest one. He was a record store guy, you know, selling. I don't think he was in college. Nan was. She was at U of M with me. We were both in college. And they started dating. He looked nothing like what he did as he started his career and went out front. He was on the drums. So it was, yeah, he had quite a journey. Oh my God. And not to be outdone by the MC5, you know, they, like I've said it before in the other episode, it was that I call it my line, the teenage call to arms heard round the world, kick out the jams, motherfuckers. I mean, that hit, you know, that was their calling card. And they did. They kicked out the jams and they became, you know, house band at the big ballroom that opened up.
Well, we're going to get to all of this in season
two.
Because I really want to keep talking about you and your family getting up until this point. So let's get back to, you're playing folk music. You haven't called it the Pleasure Seekers yet, but you're playing with your friends. And I realize rock is coming into, as you would say, the ether into the city. But was it the moment when you saw the Beatles live in 64 and said, that's what I want to do, that you transitioned over to rock? What was that epiphany for you in terms of the transition of your instrument?
It sort of solidified. You know, I'd been flirting with guitar and playing folk stuff and all that. But when Nan and me and Diane started, you know, getting together and jamming with no particular pathway in mind, but there was an excitement building, you know, in this rock stuff, and we were hearing it from different friends, and it grabbed me. It was too exciting to ignore. It was like, I knew it was like coming home. It was my path. I knew it. The minute I saw the Beatles, I knew it. It was just what I had to do. It was like that Detroit attitude hit me, you know. It's like, hey, bitch, I'm from Detroit and I owned it. You know, it was Detroit energy, and it just came out full force in me. I just felt that was my path forward, playing music, but rock.
But
it
rock.
Had to meld into rock.
I love that. And I believe, I'm pretty sure it was Wayne Kramer who said that the unofficial motto of rockers in Detroit is, quote, make me, close quote. And I can so see you with that. And so I want to tease something now out that you mentioned. You mentioned this in other episodes, but you also just mentioned it, which is obviously Motown was so influential on all of you musically. And yet with the new Detroit Rock City energy, you talk about it not being Motown, but I want you to explain to all of us a little bit more about this, because what I'm gathering is it wasn't a competition with Motown. It was almost a parallel musical journey. So can you talk a little bit about that? Was it a racial rejection? Was it a musical rejection or not? I just would love your thoughts on this.
You know what? There was no competition. I'm telling you, Detroiters, I think all Detroiters revere and respect the Motown legacies. It is infused in Detroit's DNA as much as the newer rock music. And they were synergistic and they came together. And, you know, exploring the other music through the area of the United States and UK, it just added a new element. And all of the teens were excited to explore. I mean, we used to back up the Motown guys. I mean, we backed up David Ruffin. And he said we were the best backup band he ever had. You know, Motown was our roots. It's baked in DNA. You couldn't take Detroit out of the girl, and you can't take Motown out of the girl. It just melded into an exciting new thing. And I think all the Detroit musicians pretty much felt the same, really. There was never a rejection, and there wasn't a racial thing. Motown ended up hiring white bands. They had people in their staff that were white, key positions. It wasn't that kind of a thing. My God, Diana Ross had to play secretary at their offices. You know, I mean, everybody had their part in it, including white, black, whatever you were. It was about the music, plain and simple. It was about the music. And no, I don't think there was any kind of racial thing about it or anything.
I think that's a fantastic way of putting it. It was all about the music, because that's how you've described Detroit Rock City. And so yes, whether it's Motown or whether it's rock and roll or proto punk, it was all about the music. It was not about gender per se. It was all about putting it out there, as you would say, foot on the gas and giving it your all. And you better be top notch. Otherwise, you are not going to be accepted by Detroiters.
No, you wouldn't. It's, you know, there were so many little sayings said about Detroit. You know, if you haven't lived it, if you aren't there, you can't get it. But a lot of Detroiters feel that way. I mean, I live here in Austin, Texas, but my soul is in Detroit Rock City.